Brew Strong is brought to you by Blickman Engineering, home of the Riptide. Visit them online at blickmanengineering.com.
Brewers, it's time for the beer radio you've been looking for. This is the show that dispels myths, tackles the toughest topics, and makes no apologies for geeking out on beer. Hosted by two guys that drink before they think, Jamil Zainashev and John Palmer. This is Brew Strong.
Hey, howdy, hey, my brewing brothers and sisters.
Greetings, cretins.
Welcome to Brew Strong.
There you go. Welcome. We're live. Live.
Seated.
Yeah. I've got a beer, which is going to help me because I don't know. I didn't get much sleep last night, so I'm just like lagging in my mental acuity is a little behind the curve here. A little slow.
Don't worry, Jamil. I can't tell the difference.
Exactly. Seems same as always. Same. You know who else is who isn't slow is our good friend John Blue.
Right. Mr. Speedy himself.
Yes. I've heard he's quick. I'm not sure at what, but I've heard he's quick. For me, I think he is a quick wit.
Yes.
A gritty individual. And he's also very quick and ingenious in making new brewing gear. So if you are into brewing, you know, I guess there's some people who actually listen to this that aren't into brewing. I hear that many spouses and children are subjected to this show. Why? I don't know. Maybe it's a torture thing. But if you're into brewing, check out BlickmanEngineering.com. Check out our good friends at Blickman Engineering. They make great brew gear to innovate your brew day. Whether you be a professional brewer at
5 gallon or 5 barrel system,
5 barrel, 10 barrel, or you're just starting out in home brewing and you need a good five gallon pot and kettle. Everything from the anvil to the Blickman and everything in between. They got quality gear, good people. He's been paying for the show since it started. I highly suggest, if you don't mind and you enjoy the show, send an email to our good friend John Blickman. You can send it to feedback@blickmanengineering.com. He sent that email up just so he could get feedback from the show. Tell him how much you love it or we suck, that's fine. Just as long as he knows people are listening, it would be appreciated. Today on the show, we have Nick Galton Finzi, who is a world traveling brewing consultant, been to many different breweries in many different lands, and is a friend of mine, and I wanted to bring him on because I think, he's got an interesting story that to me is, put one foot in front of the other. And, if you're whatever you love doing, if you do that, it'll lead you places and you'll have a very interesting life and career because of it. So, Nick, first off, right now you're in Southern Wales.
Just down in southern UK at the moment. So I'm in a place called Rochford, just outside of Brighton. And yes, currently working in South Wales on a new project up there for a group called Y Valley Meadery. And they've just their first foray into brewing.
So, to an American, it always fascinates me. You're in South Wales, but so New South, you're Australian, so New South Wales in Australia is how does that relate to Southern Wales? It's they thought that was like Southern Wales.
Yeah. I believe that's how it sort of came about. And the topography, very, very similar. But it's interesting to see what old South Wales looks like. I have travelled fairly extensively through New South Wales, and so now I've visited old South Wales as well. And it's a lovely, lovely part of the country. The history up there, the beer and the people are wonderful. Very, very good. Yes. It's a great place to live.
The Welsh people are just fantastic. And again, as a simple American, I'm just stunned at, you know, a place called York, and there's New York, and I'm just wow.
Yeah. And there's also a York in Western Australia as well. So there's they've been named all over the place from the original, you know, where a lot of those settlements came from. So they got named very, very similarly.
And I'm a big fan of those areas. So that's a lot of fun. Anyways, you're born and raised in Australia, and
West Australia, that is, or
West Australia, yeah.
WA.
WA, that's it. It's I was actually born in Papua New Guinea. And then we headed to Australia after that. I've lived in Australia for most of my life, and until for the last 4 years. The last 4 years have been a very intense traveling, but a lot has been through Australia. It's a wonderful place. I'm sure both of you have visited that area, and specifically probably the southwest region where most of our breweries actually come from. So we have, I think it's just shy of about 80 breweries in Western Australia now. So it's a very big brewing scene there. A lot of very talented brewers and a lot of innovation. I can't wait to host you both when we can all head back to Australia, including myself. So, we'll be able to do a bit of exploration in that area.
That'd be nice. Yeah.
Yeah. I recall, you know, when I first went to Australia, you know, the beer at some of the breweries I thought was okay. You know, wasn't. You know, there were a few great ones, and a lot of them were okay. And, you know, the homebrew was, there was a couple of great brewers, and there was a lot of so-so stuff. And then, you know, you go back, you know, a couple of years later, and then all of a sudden you're just like, wow.
Yeah. You know,
this is really going strong. And within a period of 5 years, I think, you know, they made up like 50 years of ground. I was so impressed at how quickly brewing was evolving in Australia. And I think it's just kind of a mindset there of, you know, improvement. And it was pretty impressive. And, you know, the last time I was there, I was like, man, this beer's great. You know, everybody's brewing great beer all of a sudden.
Yeah.
With so much competition, that's exactly right. You know, there was a lot of breweries that had sprung up in the last 5 to 8 years, and as a consequence of that, they've you know, the breweries that were had pioneered and had established were now having to not just produce beer, but they were having to produce good beer. So it lifted everyone's game, and that level of competition that did go up. There was a lot of deregulation that had happened in Western Australia and in Queensland, and as a consequence of that, there was a lot more players that were now in that area. So it's good, really good thing.
Well, and you started as a home brewer, and then you opened a brewery in Australia.
Yep. I started homebrewing at age 17. I was helping a friend of mine and his father clean out his garage, and we'd stumbled across was an old Alinda fermenter. So it was a 1970s brand, Australia. This thing had sat dormant for a number of years, and we dug this thing out. Bill promised us that when we'd finished cleaning out the garage at the end of the day, he would show us how to make beer. And we did make that beer, and it was terrible, absolutely dreadful. And I wonder how I can make this better. There's got to be a science behind it. And, you know, through my parents had a bit of a science background, and I thought, well, I'm going to learn this and I'm going to master this, and I'm still doing it sort of 25 years later.
Well, and being in Australia, you probably started drinking at age 7 or 8.
About 6, I think, is where they normally start.
Don't you normally? So you already had like 11 years of drinking experience. So you knew what you were, that the beer was bad.
It was time to have some quality behind it as well.
Mm-hmm. So did you pursue that and keep homebrewing, or how did you transition from that into opening your own place?
So I had. By the time I'd sort of hit 18, 19, I'd colonized my parents' garage, and there were bottles and there were trials and samples. I was even trialing things like the very early hop oils and hop oil emulsions. So this was back in 1995, 1996. And they were very, very new to market. And one of the guys who owned the homebrew shop sort of took me under his wing, and every single time I went in there, I said, "Oh, so what's new in the products this week? Where have we come?" And we've been very lucky in Australia with the Coopers homebrew kits, which were very good quality from day one. And I'm not sure if those sort of same sort of level of quality were available in the US, but the Australian Coopers kits were very good, and that's how I learned. And I just slowly, as I developed the knowledge, I'd try a new ingredient and a new batch. And every single time I brewed, I would just change one aspect. So that way I got a very good understanding about what the flavor change was. And then slowly built up my knowledge, which is good.
Well, and you also went to university for biology and...
environmental
sciences and
biochemistry.
And did you, when you were going to university, was that your goal, was to learn about brewing? Or
no, not at all. I'd already been brewing for a fair time, and at university it was just a means about being able to supply me and my buddies with quality homebrew. So I would always rock up to the parties with what I'd made and share it around, and everyone could have a bit of a try. And that sort of progressed all the way through to when I started working. So I would then showcase every single time I had a new beer, and I would showcase to that to them as well.
Well, and so out of university, and then you was like, well, my parents want me to get a job and work, and I'll open a brewery. Is that how it went?
So I headed off after that. So I'd completed my degree. I had a job offer. I did not know where I was going. I was told it was a 3-month contract. I was given a flight number. And, wow. Fronted up to the airport and checked the flight number against where I was heading. I was heading to a place called Kalgoorlie in Western Australia. It's 600 kilometres inland. It is one of the largest regional populations in WA. It's right on the border of the desert and a place called the Great Western Woodlands. It is red dirt, and I headed up there for a 3-month contract, working within the environmental industry for mining. So I used that time when I was up there to obviously my first job out. I had a lot of debt to pay off at that stage, so I did exactly that. And I continued homebrewing all the way through. So on the Friday, we were in a large share house. There was, I think, about 7 or 8 of us at the maximum numbers that we managed to pack into this house. And I'd brew, and I would produce beer for the entire house. And then on sort of Friday night, we'd have a little jug that we'd put on top of the fridge. I'd put on top of the fridge, and donations would come in, and I would ultimately end up putting anything that I had as far as dollars go back into more equipment, growing up the size. And before I realized that, I'd It had almost a 300 liter system that was now sitting and occupying in the garage, along with the electricity bill and the water bill that had gone along with it. So I'd honed some of my skills. I had many willing test subjects who were willing to try out some of these beers as well. So I eventually had earned enough money that I had a small kit sitting there and quite a lot of interest from the locals as well. And it was at that stage I bit the bullet and I purchased up one of the local warehouses that still housed a powder coating business. So I took on that powder coating, not the business itself, but actually the warehouse, until I could then afford to pay that building off. So I used the rental income and the dollars that were coming in from the brewing that I was doing on that Friday night to pay everything off, and moved into that. And I think it was about 2005, 2006. And then I started the fit out with the idea of building a commercial brewery. So it took me almost 3.5, 4 years to do the fit out for that. I had a lot of friends in trades and they helped and they worked and did very high quality workmanship, and they got paid in beer, you know. So it was a way that I could pay off people that had skills that I did not have, and they were very good about that. So it took me a long time to build and a long time to get into it. But by 2010, I had actually opened up the establishment. So it's Beaten Track Brewery in Kalgoorlie in Western Australia. And at that stage, it was one of the only regional breweries in WA. I think it was the most remote brewery in Western Australia at that stage.
It was like 500 feet from this open pit mine, the gold mine, right?
That's correct, yeah. So we have something in Kalgoorlie called the Super Pit. It is the second largest gold mine in Australia. Size of that pit is about 2 kilometers long by about 0.5 kilometer wide and about 0.5 kilometer deep. Can be seen from space. And the opening to that area was just 500 meters from my front door. So we used to get quite a lot of tourists who came through the area. They'd go and visit the Super Pit, and then they would come through and visit the brewery afterwards.
And look at a giant hole in the ground and then go, I'm thirsty. Let's go have a beer. Yeah, it seems like a perfect location.
Were there any other traditions associated being that close to the pit, like a, you know, last call tours or pissing contests?
Much and fall in the pit?
No. There was probably one of the most famous hotels, which might I add, I believe it is actually up for sale in Boulder. So there's a twin town. So it's known actually as Kalgoorlie Boulder. And the pub down in the middle of Boulder actually has a mining shaft that comes up inside the pub itself. Legend has it that the miners would pop up in the middle of the bar and get a lunchtime beer before heading back down and continuing on the activities for the afternoon. But you can actually go into the bar, and over the top of this, it has a Perspex cover, and you can actually see down a shaft all the way down to the bottom whilst you stand inside the pub. So it's pretty remarkable. Anyone who wants to check it out, it's called the Metropole Hotel in Boulder.
Let's do this. Let's take a short break. And when we come back, we'll hear more of Nick's adventures right after this.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Are you looking for a simple brewing system that's great for all grain brewing, but everything on the market seems to be full of compromises? Blickman Engineering has the answer. The Blickman Brew Easy All Grain Brewing System. The Brew Easy is a complete system with easy upgrades and a beautiful compact design, perfect for any size brewing location. At its core, the Brew Easy is built on two gorgeous Blickman Boilermaker brew kettles, a high temperature March pump, and either a top tier gas burner or the new boil coil electric heater. The Brew Easy adapter lid allows the pots to stack on top of each other, forming an efficient, strong, and compact brewing setup that comes in 5, 10, and 20-gallon batch sizes. Upgrade your BrewEasy system with full automated control by adding a Blickman Tower of Power temp controller and make moving around easy with the Blickman Kettle Cart. The BrewEasy is modular. If you already own a Boilermaker kettle, you can build your BrewEasy by purchasing just the modules you need. The new BrewEasy all-grain brewing system. See it today at BlickmanEngineering.com and brew with Blickman quality on your new BrewEasy. Easy.
Back to the two guys that know how to turn beer
into beer.
This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're back with Nick Galton-Fenty, brewing consultant, and we're kind of hearing his adventures as he got started and opened his place, and there's a lot more to tell. I do have a question for you, and this may seem odd, but having been born in PNG, have you ever heard of the Cuckoo Cuckoo?
I have heard of it, but I do not know what it is.
It's a people, a tribe in PNG. I read this book as a kid. I found this book in the library, and it was about this guy's experience kind of living with the Cuckoo Cuckoo, and they had been uncontacted before him, and it was just fascinating. It's stuck with me ever since. So I've always had this fascination with the Cuckoo Cuckoo. There you go.
No, unfortunately, I cannot shed any light on the on that particular area within Papua New Guinea. But I'll now go and look it up and see if I can find any truth to the story.
It's true. There were pictures. This is a fact. So opening your Beaten Track Brewery, what would you say was the things you did right? What were the things that you made mistakes on? What if somebody else is opening a brewery and going through, say it took you years to open that brewery. It seems like you did that right. You probably were able to, with not a whole lot of money and with, calling on friends, you were able to build something that sounded pretty special.
I'm kind of like a blunt instrument when it comes to that. I will persevere even in the sort of the face of not being able to persevere against it, and I will attempt to at least succeed on that idea. So I guess I pushed it through fairly bluntly, I guess is the best way. But I did learn a heck of a lot from that. Initially, like a lot of other brewers, went around to the outlets that I believed I could possibly sell through, and their response to everything was generally, yes, of course we can sell your beers. There aren't going to be any issues. As soon as you are ready to go, let us know and we will sell your products for you. And the reality of which, once you do produce these products, is that you can front up to these places and they are under pouring rights arrangements, or they are under a tied house. I'm not sure if anyone's familiar with these, but the taps and the advertising materials and promotional gear are all owned by larger production breweries. Mm-hmm. And as a consequence, trying to get a single tap point in there is near on impossible. So the initial customers who said, of course we can stock your items, actually they didn't know their liabilities and their products either. So it suddenly turned out that what we thought we had a market for, I did not. So the focus then turned after that to being able to sell on site from the actual warehouse itself. That also proved problematic as well. We had a funny law back in, pretty much from about 1989 through to 2016 that stated if you were a brewery, you could not sell by the glass over the counter. If you're a winery, then you could. So there was a big discrepancy between the two different products. And it took me from 2010 through to 2016 to actually push the issue through Parliament to get brewers who produce beer under a producer's license to be able to sell by the pint over the counter. If you're a winery, wineries could sell by the glass under the same license, but because it was just a different product. So that was the turning point within the business after that, because there weren't a lot of places that I could wholesale out to, nor did I have the production to really meet some of their demands. I was just a very small little brewery. So that change in legislation, which was spearheaded by a lady called Wendy Duncan, and she was an absolute champion for small breweries in Western Australia. And what she did was she took my case through. And as a consequence, we've had something like about another 20 breweries that have opened in Western Australia since that had gone through in 2016. So it was a real great outcome. For myself, it was even better because I could now sell by the pint over the counter and actually be able to sell my products. So I guess I was quite naive as far as where I could sell and how I could sell. But in doing so, I've lost, you know, 5 years of effective trade out of that as well. I guess the next thing is looking at your ground conditions and looking at actually how much room you actually need for a production commercial brewery. I'm sure yourself, Jamil, have found out that you have run out of room very, very quickly, very, very suddenly in a lot of occasions. The amount of room you think you need.
Your brewery will fill the space available always, and then you'll want more space, and it never ends. Yeah. But you have to just decide to think. I think there's a minimum that you have to have. And then, you know, once you're past that, you just have to accept the fact that you have that size, unless you're willing to buy another building or build something. You know, it's just that's what you have. So here we have about 25,000 square feet. And it's never enough. You know, it's always, but it's a tall building. So we try and fill upwards.
That's it. And you know, through that sort of mechanism, that's exactly where Beaten Track Brewery had ended up. And I had been able to take it to so far with so much room. And the new owners down there, Mitch and Alira Didarko, they are expanding, and they are moving premise, and they're moving it up to one of the main streets. So that's downtown Kalgoorlie now. To meet that demand, which is a real success story. So it's
you sold the brewery and you moved on to what?
So I had an opportunity in Nevada, and I was going to head across there to start a new operation.
That was in Elko, or?
Yeah, Elko, Nevada. That's correct. Yeah. And been across to check out sort of the ground conditions, see some of the areas that were potential. We were looking at the initially one of the old power stations that was there. It looked very promising as far as a building. So I started testing all this out, buying equipment, basically getting it all ready to go. Unfortunately, the whole business deal fell through at the 11th hour, and 10 days prior to flying out to start up in full time there, the whole system had, all my ability to be able to do that had fallen away. I suddenly found myself bankrupt and homeless overnight to a series of decisions that had happened against me through no fault of my own at all. And I found myself moving back with my parents at that stage. So I had a couple of choices. I could either, you know, accept defeat or see if I could pick up the pieces from all that and head across and salvage what I could and learn from that experience. And I did exactly that. I headed over to Nevada. I packed up what the equipment that I could salvage, anything that I couldn't, I gave away. So there was a lot of 115 volt equipment that I couldn't utilize, even if I was sort of to head back to Australia. So there's a lot of very lucky people around at that stage who ended up with some very nice, nice brewing equipment. So I then was there. I didn't have a lot of money left behind me at that stage. And I decided that I would travel across to meet with actually both of you in World Beer Cup at that stage, I think it was. So that was 2018 in Nashville.
Yeah.
I spent 3 months busing, hitchhiking, driving across the USA, stopping at every single brewery that I came to and sampling anything that I could sort of get my hands on and speaking with all the brewers. And I picked up little bits of cash work here and there as I went through. And most of it was just for food and board. So, I was sort of sleeping in cars and motels and all that kind of thing at the time. And I learnt a lot about brewing. And if I wasn't stopping at a brewery, I was stopping at one of the hiking trails and trailheads and going for a bit of a walk and learning a lot about the US and about its brewing scene and about the people. So I loved it. It was very good, but ultimately ended up at World Beer Cup to steward there with Chris Latham, who sort of set me on that path. And for those who don't know who Chris Latham is, she's the events and competition coordinator with the American Brewers Association. And she put me on the path to how and who and why could I speak to. She was a little bit of a lifeline at that stage. So it was amazing. And she introduced me to a lot of her friends, and a lot of them invited me in. I would teach them everything that I knew about beer and beer tasting, and in turn they would, share food and give me some place to live. So it was awesome.
Well, clearly the pivotal point in your life was talking to John and I. at World Beer Cup. I think it all hinges on that. The story was going nowhere until then. And then your life actually meant something. Is that correct?
If you've seen on my webpage there as well, you'll see the photos with both of you and books, etc., that have inspired me all the way through, and I have learned a heck of a lot from. So thank you very much to sharing both of your knowledge for what you have done. It is really, really good. What you guys have both done for the industry is spectacular. So
was there some people or something in the United States that was really memorable, or one piece of knowledge that you learned about brewing that really you've carried forward or that you share with other people since?
The one, and it's not even a significant moment as far as learning. I do remember walking in North Carolina in Wilmington, and walking down the main street there, and for no other reason, I looked up and I saw the Untapped sign from the head office that's down there in Wilmington. And I don't know what made it. I don't know if you've seen the front office of what Untapped looks like. It is a horseshoe box that's only about 3 meters wide, and there's a single little sign that sort of hangs out the front. And to my knowledge, I think that is its head office. And I don't know why I looked up at that stage, but there was no other beer paraphernalia or anything else like that. But there was the Untapped sign. I went, very interesting. I, I wonder how I've come to be at this place at this time with the beer sign hanging over my head with, you know, one of the biggest sort of social media providers on beer that there probably is. And I just thought that was kind of fascinating. But everyone who I met taught me something about beer and how they got there and what their processes were. Mm-hmm. Every single brewer that I met was too excited to tell me about their products and how they came to be as well. And I learned a lot from every single person that I came through. So it's really good.
And then you spent some time with the folks in Boise, Idaho as well, the homebrewers out there. Let's take one more short break. And when we come back, I want to hear about your time in Boise right after this.
Learning to brew has never been so disgusting. This is Brew Strong.
All right, we're talking with Nick Galton-Finzi about his adventures in brewing. And before the break, I was asking you about the folks in Idaho because I actually really enjoy Idaho. I've been there a number of times. It's one of our, I think it was our first out-of-state distributor was in Idaho. And, you know, I used to travel out there and people ask me, so I'm there visiting, you know, working the market, talking to people, doing events. And people would ask me, they're like, so we're really appreciative, but why are you in Idaho? Question. I'm like, well, why not? And they're like, most people don't come to Idaho with their beer, you know, and now it's become like a destination for pretty much everybody leaving California is going to Idaho. So kind of like Idaho or Arizona, and a lot of Idaho's, it's a beautiful place. Lots of great people. The beer scene there is exploding. The beer and restaurant scene is exploding. It's really fascinating and very enjoyable. But what year were you in Idaho?
So that was 2018. Boise, if you haven't visited Boise in Idaho, it is an amazing place. As Jamil said, the brewing scene down there, you can do the Greenbelt Walk, which is all linked by cycleways. So there is no interaction with any sort of traffic at all. There are hire scooters that you can hire all over the place, and you can get to and from 8 breweries just up that just up in that one area. The beers are of great quality. The food and downtown scene in Boise is amazing, and they've got a great homebrew club there. So one of the guys who I'd helped train up, a guy called Ben Hinkle, and he's still brewing at the moment. We set up his basement as a small microbrewery. As in a home brewery, sort of microbrewery. And the enthusiasm from they grow their own hops there. They are innovative as far as what they do. Their Facebook page always has little bits and pieces going on as far as the quality of it. But the scene in Boise is amazing. I can't rate probably behind Wilmington, with Boise in Idaho would be one of my favorite places to go and visit. And I always do try and get back there whenever I do head back to the US.
Yeah, it's an amazing place. And, you know, in some ways, you know, I see other little knots of this same thing happening. You know, Reno is kind of, you know, taking that same kind of course where, you know, they're adding more, you know, great restaurants and, you know, breweries and cool breweries, cool places to go. It's like these little enclaves are starting. Speaking of Reno, I did want to mention our other sponsor, main sponsor, Brew Chatter, brewchatter.com. RJ and Josh, great folks. They have a wonderful homebrew shop there. Anything you need for your brewing day, they've got. You can order it online or you can go in person.
and talk to those guys. They're always there, and they've got you know, the freshest ingredients and the coolest equipment. So check them out, brewcheddar.com. All right, so you did the Boise thing, and then where did you go? What happened after that?
Well, the time, I then headed up to Canada, and I repeated the same process as what I'd done. I started off in Winnipeg, it was, and I then moved all the way from there through to Toronto, stopping at, again, every single brewery. And the people that I met at those brew pubs on my travels were just simply amazing. Friends who I will always keep in contact with, people like Chris, who sort of, you know, we just ended up getting talking at the pub, and he said, "Oh, I've got spare place. Let's get a bunch of beers." And and he was a real beer enthusiast. He wanted to know everything about beer, and I met so many people like that on that trip.
They're Canadians. They're nicer like that, you know. In America, you don't get that, but in Canada, you sure.
Yeah, I had the same experience in both countries. It was quite good. I finally rolled up in Toronto, and I'd sort of was trying to work out what my next move was when I had a phone call from a friend of a friend of a friend who said, "Oh, I know this guy who's a brewer, and they were looking to start a brewery in an estate in the UK. And they phoned me up and said, "Are you interested in coming across?" And I said, "Well, look, you know, I've got no place to be and no rush to do it." So they said, "Right, we'll buy your ticket across." And so I jumped across and landed in London, and then made my way over to a place called the Newnham Estate, in which they are a very old historic estate. It's the largest land holding in Oxfordshire, and it has a number of different properties that are on the premise, including an old packing shed. And they wanted to turn that into a brewery. It's still an ongoing task and process. There's a lot of approvals that do need to go through. There's a places like a deconsecrated church that are on site that may well form part of the future of that sort of area. So I did an assessment for them, and that is still ongoing. But in the meantime, I'd sort of met a series of other people through getting to Newnham Estate that said, "Oh, we are looking for brewers and we do need some knowledge. The UK micro brewing scene doesn't have a lot of keg sort of style beers. It has a lot of cask beer, as you're probably well aware, and cask makes up a majority of a focus in everywhere that is sort of outside of Bristol and London. Bristol and London are very progressive sort of areas, but if you move into some of the more traditional areas like Kent and Dorset, they are staunchly cask, traditional, real ales, Camara, and it is an incredible scene. If you've never had the opportunity to try a fresh cask of real ale through a hand pump or directly out of a cask, it is a life-changing experience, and I have to know how to do this. I was working at a number of places, including Breakwater down in Dover, and they've got a great little tap room and tap house in Dover. So if you ever wanted to visit the White Cliffs down there, they are the only micro pub and microbrewery down there. And Tom, the head brewer down there, produces just an exceptional quality cask and keg beers. So I do urge anyone who is traveling through Dover to go check that out. I then picked up more work as I headed across over to Dorset and at Dorset Brewing Company. And Dorset Brewing Company was a very interesting place. They had they've been established for the last 25 years. They'd taken on some of the assets of if anyone's familiar with the Thomas Hardy's ale, and they'd so that was from the Eldridge Pope brewery that shut down in 2002, And the Aldridge Pope Brewery had been established, 1870, I believe it was. So it's over 100 years old, the brewery, and it's right in the center of Dorchester there. So there was all the older sort of casks that a guy called Giles Smith then picked up. I learned so much about cask ales, real ales from Giles and the crew that was there. I could also pass on a lot of my information because they were looking to modernize up some of their mechanisms. And I was doing a lot of the QAQC recipe development and then redefining recipes. A lot of these recipes had been in existence for around 10 years and needed a little bit of a shake up as far as costings, looking at ways to be more efficient. And as you're both aware, in order to be you are a business. You're not just producing good beers. You have to turn a dollar in order to be able to do that as well. Mm-hmm. And I was very thankful to that position that I got there. So where did I head up from there? So from there, I had an opportunity to head over to the West Indies, and I headed to the Carib Brewery in the West Indies and started learning how to produce lagers and some of the downstream products from them. So they produce some of their brands like Carib, Skull, Stag, Guinness, Mackeson's, Royal Stout, and again the guys there. The brewery was established there in 1960, so it is a very, very old brewery in its own right. And I did learn a lot from the guys there.
So that's a lager brewery,
yeah.
And they produce Guinness.
That's correct. Yeah, they're the only licensees in that area. There are four production breweries.
This is the story that we've heard. It's like Guinness sends out kind of like an extract that is added to a lager beer, and that is what Guinness is in those areas. What can you say on this subject?
I guess it's kind of like the Colonel Sanders and the, you know, the 11th herbs and spices, you know, the 11th one that gave it away. There are definitely a lot of trade secrets that do happen with that. And unfortunately, I'm not at liberty to say, but they do a little bit of a care package. And there are things that are sent from the things that are sent from Dublin and Ireland, and I believe it is just probably a mix of.
Would it be correct to say that the Carib Brewery only produces lagers, uses lager yeast? Uses lager yeast.
Yeah, they are. They do only use lager yeast. Yeah, but the it's the smooshed up leprechaun and clover. That's the clincher to it. So if you're wondering what the 11th herb and spice was, we'll just say it could be one of those.
Well, and you said they make the Royal Stout?
Yeah.
I've had that. Where did I have it last? I think I had it in Singapore or maybe Thailand or something. Royal Stout, maybe it was Singapore. It was delicious. I thought it was actually one of the better ones. I'm not sure if it's the same Royal Stout, but it was a Royal Stout in can.
One of their original brands. So it was one of their brands that was actually established in 1960. It's a milk stout, 6%, so it's strong. Mm-hmm. And if you had it in a can, may have been brewed under license somewhere else from the island themselves. It's produced in a 275ml returnable glass package. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the great things about the island is that all the glass is returnable, reusable. The size of the cleaning and washing facilities there is just simply enormous, and it's roughly about the size of your whole brewery as far as just their glass and glass packaging. So they export from there to the US, the UK, and to northern Brazil as well. So it's quite an exercise in logistics.
I've seen the Carib beer, but I haven't seen. I don't think I can get the Royal Stout here in the US.
No. So you've got Royal Maiden produced in Florida by one of their sister breweries.
Oh, there you go. There you go. So you got out there, and what is it? You learned something about lager brewing there, but you know, what did you do for them? What was your purpose there?
So my basic role was actually to introduce new products, and specifically IPA. So just finished doing a rollout of the IPA just over the weekend. And so we were looking at mechanisms about using existing product streams and how to tailor those without having to go through developing an entirely new product line. So with the Caribbean, and specifically for St. Kitts and Nevis, 70% of the island's GDP is actually generated by tourism, which is significant. The population isn't huge. We've only got about 35,000 people who live there permanently. Up to 15,000 people a week visit the island in a normal week of trade. So it's a very important part of their economy. With the lack of the tourist boats coming through and with the difficulties of the returning students who are coming back to the area, St. Kitts also has one of the largest veterinary training schools in the world, and a lot of USA students come through to do their training there. Their selection is 5 different kinds of lagers, so a lot of the students sort of tend to query, oh, can we get an IPA here? And there were a few smaller outlets that were being able to import from the US, but unfortunately with the trading conditions with COVID, the students went there, the businesses unfortunately shut down, and there wasn't a lot of work that could be done towards it. We still managed to develop the products. However, everything sort of gone on to hiatus until 2022, until we can actually get the markets reestablished. So that ended on the first time. So that was the last tour that I did there, and that was back on 2019. Start of 2020. So I flew pretty much just back as the borders all shut in St. Kitts. I flew back into the UK, made a number of frantic phone calls to people saying, I need work and I need somewhere to live. I guess the one thing I haven't sort of provided is over the last 4 years, I've been traveling around with a 10 kilo backpack, and that is pretty much all that I have to my name. So I've been living out of a 10 kilo backpack for 4 years now. When I flew back in and I contacted Dorset Brewing, and they said, well, everything is all shut down, but we need someone to maintain yeast and online sales and bottling and production. So I slept on the floor of the brewery for 5 months whilst I took care of all their day-to-day operations.
This is the kind of employee I need. Somebody who will just like sleep on the floor of the brewery and make everything happen. If you want to come out and hang out, Boise is not very far from where we're at. It's a short flight. A longer drive, but you know, you could come and hang here. I've got plenty of floor space for you to lay down. I could offer you sacks of grain to sleep on. I'm just saying.
That would be a luxury.
Well, if you'll spring for a blanket, Jamil, I think he might be interested. Yeah,
I'll get you 2 blankets.
I'll hold you to that, Jamil.
It's California. It's not that cold.
No, exactly right. But, yeah, the it was again a really good experience. Maintaining the brewery and in that sort of time. I mean, it's very much, as everyone sort of uses the term, unprecedented. So having to run a UK 20 barrel brew house, so we're talking 3,500 liters. Not sure what the US barrel equivalent is there, but having to run that, you know, as a sole person for a 5-month stretch was a good challenge. And the yeast that we use at that brewery is a 1970 strain Bass yeast. Mm. And it is a house yeast, and it requires a lot of care and attention. It requires brewing every, normally four times a week, but due to production requirements, we're only really brewing about once every 10 days to 14 days. Mm. So having to come up with some clever mechanisms of how to feed this yeast and how to maintain something that was so old and so historic. And it is a very unique yeast. It's an 83% attenuating yeast. It gives incredibly neutral profiles at 18 degrees. It develops quite a lot of ester formation at 22 degrees, and it's so highly flocculent, keeping it in suspension can be a little bit challenging sometimes, but it's such a unique thing. And we're up to generation almost 300 of that particular yeast, and it's a 20% wild yeast, 80% original strain, and I've never tasted anything quite like it.
Now, what kind of fermenters are you using there?
So we are on 330 barrel uni tanks. We're on 12 barrel open fermenters and one bright tank. And the open ones I try not to use as much, but they're definitely an overflow if they're actually required. But we do produce real ale and cask ale from there. So a single run would yield somewhere between about 80 and 90 casks of beer, which is, with all the pubs now, I mean, we just hit the first anniversary of lockdown in the UK here just yesterday. So it's pretty much been about 12 months of continuous rolling trade shuts, which has been decimating for the industry. No pubs are open. Anyone who doesn't have a tap room suffering quite severely. The pubs are due to open on the 14th of next month. So anyone who does have an outdoor beer garden, and everyone's is eagerly gearing up to provide pubs. So I'm sure there'll be a nationwide celebration as soon as that's that's happened.
The sound of beer glasses being drained. I've heard that the uni tanks, the cylindrical uni tanks, will cause the yeast to flocculate more. Some of these strains that were normally would top crop easily, they in particular, I heard this related to Fuller's when they shifted tanks, when they brought in this equipment. I guess we're told they brought in this equipment to originally do lagers, and then they ended up not doing the lagers, but switched their other beers over to it. And they found that the yeast started to, drop to the bottom because of that. Have you seen something similar to that? I've seen, a lot of, top crop beers there. I've seen Utakers, you usually don't see the two mixed.
No, exactly right. I was genuinely surprised by when you're doing sort of findings tests and flocculation tests on this, how they behave so differently in the different barrels. We've got, as I said, the two much smaller but open fermenters behave very, very differently and produce a vastly different beer to that of the uni tanks. The pressure settling and even just the pressure at the bottom of those cones in suppressing the esters is remarkable. And we've done a number of trials there, splitting that into smaller fermenters, and we get a completely different beer from each different vessel we put into. But same wort and same yeast, and the size of the vessels really does have an effect on it.
I remember when I started homebrewing, one of the things I was curious about was, you know, they started coming out with these tiny little conical fermenters, they, you know, glass carboys, plastic buckets, and then people were also fermenting in corny kegs, you know, tall and skinny. And so I did a side-by-side on all of those, and each beer was different. You could taste the difference between these things in a blind triangle. And I was shocked. You know, I thought, well, you know, but you know, the flat bottom of the carboy versus the you know, the skinny, you know, kind of a little bit coned of the corny kegs, and then the conical fermenter. And people still don't believe me, but I preferred the heat beer out of the carboys, the glass carboys. I always thought that was best, at least flavor-wise to me. I think a big part of it was the broad, flat surface of the yeast when it flocculated. You still had a large yeast surface area versus all these other fermenters. You had, you know, a kind of compacting of the yeast and the surface area presented for cleaning up at the end of fermentation was reduced. And I think that was the difference, you know, in hindsight. But fascinating. Yeah. You know, the differences in it, just changing your fermenter geometry and what it does to the beer.
Well, we've got our yeast expert right on hand with us. You know, John Palmer's, you know what he's written as far as that is, incredible. You know, some of that research and knowledge there is just unreal.
Thank you.
right. One last break, and we'll be back with more of Nick right after this.
Back to the beer guys that make other beer guys look like wine guys. Brew strong.
All right, we're back. Nick, I got another question for you. Of all the beers that you have brewed commercially, or breweries that you've worked with commercially, does any one of them, you know, stand out to you, or any particular beer really stand out to you as one of your, you know, or maybe you got a couple of, you know, real favorites that you think are world class?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, from the stuff that I've made, I spent my first probably 6 to 8 months redeveloping a lot of the Dorset Brewing Company's portfolio, and in changing some of those up and getting the balance and the salt ratios and the malt profiles correct, it's been some of the best beer that I've ever had in my life. I haven't tasted anything quite like it, and as soon as I go away and do not have access to it, I miss it. I miss the taste, I miss the flavor, I miss that that level of complexity from such a simple malt bill, and from such a, you know, one or two hop sort of but as I said, what is the key to that particular brewery is it's house strain yeast. It is, it's just something I've never experienced before. Every single brewery that I've worked at, I have learned, and I've been taught something, you know, by the brewers that have been there. They've always said, oh no, we do it this. Science doesn't normally say that you would do that, so explain out why you would do it. And there's as we know with beer, you sort of got 90% maybe science, you know, 2% luck, and then the 8% witchcraft that sort of goes on with that. And sometimes it's the witchcraft that gives the that little edge over. As far as commercial that I haven't brewed, I would say the pre bottle con- when they used to do the bottle conditioning of the Hoegaarden Grand Cru, when it had the forbidden fruit yeast that was associated with that and re-fermented in the bottle, was probably one of my favorite all-time beers until it changed. So I have been on a quest ever since to recreate that Grand Cru using those yeast. And I'm not even sure you can still get hold of forbidden fruit as far as a strain goes, but
it's banked. I think you can get it. I fully expected you to mention Heretic, but that's okay. That's okay. I thought that's where we're going, but apparently not. One of my favorites is Harvey's, their best bitter, because it's that same thing. You know, I guess they have 9 or 11 organisms in their culture at this point, and you know, it develops this thing. And you know, there's a lot to be said for, well, the brewer, you know, thought it tasted good, you know, and the customers thought it tasted good. And so it just went that way. And then they made a choice of, well, this tastes better. And, you know, the culture just kind of, you know, they started putting some natural selection, a little bit of pressure on, we want it to taste this way. Mm-hmm. And over time, it just became, you know, this great beer. I really, you know, would love to, you know, hear where, like, the moment the yeast starts to drift away from what we started with, it's like, out with that, something, you know, get a new pitch, start over. And, you know, at the first inkling, we do that. I would love to just run a pitch of yeast and, you know, do whatever we do with it and just kind of make selections based off of taste and see where it goes. But that's just not something that, you know, a U.S. Brewery tends to do.
Mm. No, and it is a risky process, because if any of you, you know, well, as I said, some of these yeasts have been harvested over 300 times before they've, you know, before we even sort of looked at doing a reprop or looking at anything like that. But that is what makes the beer, the organisms. The yeast themselves, as I said, it's 20% wild yeast component, have adapted perfectly to those conditions over that 25-year period. And they are so at home as far as their fermentations and the profiles and how they've been treated, that they suddenly behave very reliably as far as their taste and flavors, which is completely counterintuitive to what you'd think with a yeast. And it's, you know, as we've all done, we've sort of go to about six or seven pitches and then have to blend, you know, the first pitch of you know, a new prop with seven, so we can blend out some of those weird flavors that go on with the first lot. And then but yeah, you know, I haven't experienced anything quite like that one.
One of the things I think people don't appreciate about the UK brewing scene, you know, people are like, oh, Belgium and, you know, all of the flavors and all this, you know, in the UK, there's, you know, that exists too. There is history, and there is,
right.
You know, these cultures that have, you know, been developed in this way of brewing that is unique. And I don't think it's appreciated as much because the beer is so delicate that it does not travel well. It has to be live and fresh and, you know, real, for want of a better word, you know, to really appreciate what's going on. And exactly. You can't bottle that up and ship it like you can, you know, some of these Belgian beers, German beers, whatever. And, you know, and so I think it's in great danger of being lost because nobody can appreciate it unless you travel there.
Yeah, completely. I mean, you look at some of those, you know, I've been very fortunate enough to see all the behind the scenes and not hugely involved in them, but like places like Hall and Woodhouse. I mean, Hall and Woodhouse started in 1777 It's an exceptionally old brewery.
So a newer brewery, yeah, on UK terms.
Yeah.
That's right. It's the new kid on the block. That's it. Yeah. It's, 1777, Shepherd Neame. It does Spitfire and
you spent time there as well.
Yeah. I not as far as production goes, but as far as being able to speak with the engineers and the brewers and experience all of their products. I have one of my friends who is involved on their board side of things, and I've been very fortunate to see a lot of their behind the scenes sort of processes there as well. The Spitfire is an incredible beer. And again, the history behind it and the age of these breweries. I mean, they're new. They refurbished their new mash tunnel, I think, was in 1950. That was their new refurbished one.
So brand new.
70 years old. I think that people underestimate exactly how intimately involved as far as pubs and breweries go and happen in the UK. You could always get a pint of ale in the pub. The pub was your original internet. It was where you had your mail sent. It's where you had it's where you met up with friends, where you swapped all the ideas. And before, levels of communication, everything revolved around the pub. It was such an important cornerstone, and you can't go into a single village in anywhere in the UK without going down a road called Brewer's Mews or Brewer's Road or Malting's Street. We always had a Malting's house just about in every single village, so it was the cornerstone of British, a British way of life. So I think, when everyone sort of says, oh, the pubs are all shut here, I don't think people understand exactly what the ramifications of that are, because everything has revolved around pubs for so long. The big brewers own pubs, and some of the big brewers own 300 pubs, and they supply the pubs. There's so many independents, which are your they're the carriers of all the smaller brewers, but yeah, it's big.
Now what's next for you?
Very good question. Okay, it's so at the moment I'm involved with a place called the Wye Valley Meadery, and they've just moved into their first foray in brewing. We've just put down the first two batches. They were based in Chepstow, Southern Wales. We've just finished moving their entire brewery in under 4 weeks, re-established that brewery, and have now put down the first two beers, which I'll be traveling back up there next week to go and package. So we've got two new ones. We've got the Hive Mind IPA, a 5.8%, very simple malt spills, single hop citra, something designed just to showcase. We did a test trial batch of that in August of last year, and that sold very, very well. And so we're doing a second run of that one. And then secondly, the Big Smoke, which is a 7% smoked porter. We're using all Warminster malts in that one. So from Warminster, a very old heritage malt house here in the UK. I don't know if you both had a chance to use Warminster malts at all.
No.
So it's a smaller malting house, but great quality. And I've had limited use of their malts so far, but what I've seen, it's been really, really good. So they're mead producers. They also produce a range of modern meads. So we're looking at ways of streamlining their processes, reducing their fermentation times. They do a traditional mead, which is a 14%, and we're looking, they're previous production on that was around 6 months, and I'm looking to reduce that down to 1 to 2 months for production by essentially applying the same sort of techniques for brewing as we do for mead production. So got some the two guys there, two brothers, Matt and Kit Newell, and they Matt runs all his own hives, so they have all their own bees, all their own hives. They harvest all their own honey, full use in the meadery itself. And so I'm being taught a lot about mead production there as well, which is very, very exciting. So we go out and don all the beekeeping seats and we're just in the start of the season at the moment, and hopefully we're just using last year's honey. So all the beers that we produce all have a honey component into them. So we are using all their own honey for the production. And, very excited by this process. So the tap room is either occur at their warehouse and production facility itself. And the second place we're looking at doing it is in a place called Caldecott Castle. Caldecott Castle, built in, I think it was 1067. So, again, a very new, modern facility. Yeah. And to my knowledge, it'll be the first tap room in a castle in the world. So I'm not sure of any other tap rooms that have been built into castles. The Grade 1 heritage listed building, so it's going to hold a number of challenges as far as what we can and cannot do. So but you know, drinking a horn of ale, braggot or mead from a castle built in 1067, I think holds quite a lot of appeal to
I definitely want to visit.
Yeah. That'd be good.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the Y Valley. Is that the same valley where the Y Target hops come from? Do you know?
Look, I actually saw them. Because I know they're being produced in New Zealand as well at the moment. I did see. I haven't managed to follow a lot of the latest trends, but I did see Y hops were being offered from New Zealand in a email that I saw this morning. I do not know, unfortunately. I'm going to say it's one of the only whys that I've come across there. So that, if I do find out, I'll let you know, definitely.
Okay. Yeah. Another reason to come visit, yeah.
I can't wait for you both to be able to travel again. You can both come and check it out, and I can host. We've got quite a lot of people who have lined up ready to go for hopefully October of this year. So... obviously as soon as we're all allowed, let's do some collaboration brewing there, and we'll do some cask ales and some you know, hand pumped poured ales as well, and you can see and taste for yourself, because I'd love some of your feedback on some of these products, because I think I'm so excited about them, and I think you guys will be as well.
Nice.
Sounds good. Yeah.
I'll plan on it. Who knows? Maybe GBBF happens this year. Hard to say. It's kind of one of those things that may or may not happen. I don't know. But I'm always interested. Great. All right. Well, thank you, Nick, so much for joining us. I could talk to you for hours, but we've got to call it in, because the shows are the show what they are.
Thank you.
Enjoy the show. Oh, and if anybody wants to get hold of you for consulting, did you want to give any sort of way to contact you?
Yeah, they can get hold of me via at Nick's Ale House, all one word, and it's all on Twitter or Instagram, so at Nick's Ale House. Please feel free to get in touch. I love to see a brewery succeed, and I really enjoy what the brewing community has to offer. If you've got queries, comments, if you've got anything that you think I could help you with, please let me know, because I'd love to learn as well. And thanks very much to the whole brewing community who got me here and have taught me everything that I know, including you both. So I love your books. I love the enthusiasm that you both put into the industry and the time and effort that you both have you know, allowed all of us to reap the benefits of your knowledge.
Thank you. That's very, very kind of you. All right. That's our show for today. Thanks for listening. And keep on brewing. Brew strong, everybody.
Brew strong.